2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari'a, says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari'a noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayyad, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 7 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Sari'a has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its 7th anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots, but the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamadi. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله everyone
عليكم السلام ورحمة الله Welcome dear audience, this is Youth Station
And you are listening to IRB English Radio Well, in today's episode, we're going to discuss some very interesting stuff in here And Brother Hassanain is my co-host
السلام عليكم
سلام وعليكم السلام This is going to be an interesting session with you
Usually in our shows, we target the audience, the youth audience. So,
Youth is in your heart. Everyone, please listen to us, no matter how old you are.
So, dear young people, let's talk about old people today. Let's talk about the adults, yes. adults as in the elderly people. If you're annoyed or bothered by the constant advisors of the old people or the elderly people, so this show is for you. Stay with us.
Yes, we're going to talk a lot for you.
But we respect all the adults.
Yes, of course.
May Allah bless them all.
And help them to stop lecturing us.
Bad lectures, like, you know, the wrong lectures. Not specifically
yes.
every lecture.
Also, good lectures need to have a pattern. It does have a pattern.
Sister Asma, so are you annoyed by the advisors of the adults?
Of course. When I was younger, yes, a lot. Now, since I'm getting older...
You're trying to say that you yourself as an adult?
And right now?
Yeah.
I'm starting to enter adulthood.
Nah, so it means that you're in a stage where you annoy others.
Yes.
You annoy...
Since I have a younger sibling, then I think I have that role as well. Because he sometimes mentions that to me, that you're starting to lecture me and it's so bad to stop doing that.
Okay, so it was referring to you when we were talking about the old people bothering young children.
Actually, I'm not like those nosy advisors. Mm-hmm. I'm much of a moderate person.
That's the point. That's what all the adults think, that they are not the nosy advisors.
Exactly. Because we have always been, all of us have been there, you know? We know how the story goes. We shouldn't react to them with so much of pressure. because then they would never come to us, and then they would never listen to us. And after a certain level, they would not respect us even. You know what I mean? Whatever we say is going to lose its meaning. And if you say something a million times, then there would be no value for the thing you're saying, even if it's right.
Yeah, but for a fact, we all know that we, at some point of time, we have to seek advice from our adults. You know, as mentioned in the narratives as well, like we have to seek advice from the adults, like someone who knows better than us and someone who's been experienced.
You know, it has got a condition. They must have the language at first. Then they must know the truth, because maybe they're judging me.
Yeah.
Maybe they do not know the whole truth. And what they are saying is just based on a conclusion they have made on an illusion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Like for this, for this, I don't think there's a special, a specific standard for this. Like, it depends upon the
situation.
For
advising?
No, I mean, you know, someone being wrong or right on this.
Yes.
So, like, there's not a specific standard. Like, it depends upon the situation. Sometimes what happens is, you know...
And we should consider the fact that we're not the one who's going to dispense hell and heaven.
Yeah, and, like, someone, a youth, consider a young boy, he wants to do something, but then his elder sibling or his uncle, someone comes, you're too young for this, I know better than you. You shouldn't do this. Whereas, like, he has done a whole lot of research on that, and he has reached to a certain point that where he thinks that, you know, doing this is better for him.
Yes.
So without, you know, actually studying what he's trying to do, you know, the adults come and advise him.
Exactly.
And he thinks, like, you know, over here they're just getting nosy. And
You know, I told you, it does have a condition. You should follow specific rules. Even in Islam, we have that when you are going to have advice for someone, firstly, be so kind. That's the first thing. Because kindness is the common language between all people. Even if there is a very stubborn child, if you talk to them with kindness, then they would be attracted to you. And after a while, maybe they would follow you as a role model. So you have to be kind at first. Then consider the situation they are in. How they say it, they say, before putting yourself into their shoes, do not judge them. So at first, see as a young person what they are doing and why they are doing it. Perhaps they do not have enough of information. Try to clarify the situation for them and then try to guide them in a way that is much like unconscious way. You know, there are some certain ways that you do teach people about good things, but you do not say it directly.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, I do not like someone lying to me, then I don't lie.
Yeah.
If as an adult I lie myself, then I could not consider my youngsters not to lie to me.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
We are in Youth Station and we're talking about the advices.
Yeah. Like if I plan to do something, choose a specific field to study. So, like, I have done my research on it. I have completed my homework.
And that's very common. It happens to many people.
Yeah, so now I seek advice from the, you know, experts in that particular field. And, you know, I ask, like, what's good for me and what's better for me? So over here, I'm seeking advice from adults, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, this is a stage where you need to seek advice. You need to
discuss
with others.
Also, there might be some people who advise you in a wrong way because they have not been successful in the major they have picked. They would advise you to go for another major that they have loved to pick.
No, I mean... You need to discuss it with someone who has already experienced
it. Yes, yes.
So you don't know that. You should know the consequences of it, like the good side of it and the bad side of it.
Exactly.
So now you have done your homework. Now you decide to opt for that field. But, you know, so there's some random old man coming and he's like, you know, just don't do it. I know better, you know.
Yeah.
What I do is at these times...
As for me, I would never look back to that person again.
No, as for me, what I do is, you know, when I feel like, oh man, come on. Now this guy is getting nosy and he's like, you know, just... He's getting inquisitive and he's trying to interfere.
You ignore
him. I just keep quiet. I just stay calm and I'll ignore him. When he goes away, I carry on with my work.
Exactly. That's true. That's what I'm telling you. You know, the elder people have to notice this very fact that sometimes after a specific point, when your word does not make any difference, then you stop saying that because maybe what you're saying is just annoying.
Yeah.
And it does not make any change. It does not have any value for the person you're talking to. You have to change perhaps your way. You have to say it in another format in a way that it does make change or you convey your meaning in a better way.
Yeah, but not forgetting that every coin has got two sides.
Exactly.
So here this youth, this youngster, he might be correct on this side. And the old man who is advising him, he might be wrong.
Yes.
But sometimes, many times it happens that the youngster... He's trying to do something which might be harmful for him.
He's a responsible adult.
Like if we put ourselves in the place of adults for our younger siblings or for our younger brothers and
sisters. Just imagine a parent who has a teenager boy or girl.
Yeah. So he wants to do something which might actually be harmful for him. The person, he comes and he advises him. And now what the young child again thinks are, he's just getting nosy.
Mm-hmm.
The elders, they know more than us.
Uh-huh, yes.
So to avoid this, what we can do is, you know, there should be a particular way. So, you know, we should be able to convince him. Mm-hmm. You know, we should show him the right path. Like, we should tell him about the consequences. We should explain to him the whole thing. If you just say, just don't do it, of course he's going to take you wrong.
You know,
just tell him the reason why he shouldn't do it.
Yes, yes. We were talking for the youth. Now, another point which is against them is that sometimes they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And without going through any assumption, they do something which is going to harm them, as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Their parents, their adult people that are around them are going to give them some advices and they do not pay any attention to it, which is going to lead nowhere. If we want to say it in general, you have to consider the person who is advising you.
Yeah.
And listen to what they say. If that is logical, if that has got some points that would add into your knowledge, then don't be so biased about advice.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's going to help you a lot more than it might harm you.
Mm-hmm.
So just some minutes of listening to an experienced person who does need a good for you is good.
Being a good listener or listening to some advices is not a bad thing.
Exactly.
You know, you can be a good listener. There's no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But only when you have that ability to make decisions after that, where you can, you know, you can identify the right and the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't have to accept everything you hear.
Exactly. That's the point. You listen to every single thing. And we have it in our Islamic hadith also. Or it's a verse from the Holy Quran that says, "Man yastama'una al-qawl fayattaba'una ahsana."
They listen to different opinions and go for the best one.
Exactly. So we have to listen, but it does not going to bother you. For some minutes, you listen to a person and then you pick the best thing you have heard and listened about.
You have to be smart.
Yes, yes. You have to be very intelligent in order to find out between the good and the bad, which is good and which is bad. It's going to do you a lot of benefits. We are in Youth Station and we're talking about the advices that are not very much always good, but we have to listen to different opinions and then to pick the best one. So also we have a saying that says the worst vice is advice, you know? The worst vice is advice. The wrongest thing you could do is advice. Because people always react to advices like in a very biased way. But it is not good. We say it that some elderly are very much annoying in the way they are going to tell us some advices. But it's going to be unfair if we say all of it is wrong. All of what they say is wrong. After all, they're experienced people and they know something maybe that would do some benefits to us.
Yeah, there could be, because there could be different results. Like you have done this, you reach to a certain result, and the if someone else is, you know, does it, he reaches to a different result. And many times, so, you know, if you're talking about specifically about advices, sometimes I feel like there's a lack of advice. You know, you don't advise at a point where you have to.
That's like, also another side of the story.
Like when you see someone doing something wrong, or you just see someone who can do better with your advice, you don't advise it there.
Because you had a history, perhaps. You have seen people who do not listen to your advice. Then you say, okay, why do I have to do it then? I just skip it. Even if it is good, I'm not going to do it. Like what we see nowadays, you know, people are not interacting with each other in the way of giving advices. I would think, it's none of my business. Why do I have to advise them? After all, they're not going to listen to me. While what I'm going to advise them is going to be beneficial for them, but they're not listening. So that also is another side of the story, which is, you know, dangerous as well.
Yeah, thank you so much, dear audience, for staying with us. So that's all the time we had for today. So the conclusion, we were talking about, you know, advice and, you know, the adults sometimes advising the youngsters or the youth. So they become nosy sometimes. So we hear, like we said, that, you know, for the one who is advising, he has to identify, to figure out the situation where he needs to advise
to be very
and
considerate
where
he
does not have to. And the one who is listening to the pieces of advice, so for them, we said that listen, there's no problem
be
in
patient.
Listening.
Yeah, give be some patient. Listening and then
yeah,
making.
Just listen to different opinions and just choose the best one. Mm-hmm. With that being said, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for listening.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN Expert Says Zionist Regime Practices Apartheid Against Palestinians. Here's more.
Thank you.
The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians, and third states should support accountability efforts at international courts. So states Michael Link, an independent United Nations human rights expert from Canada, in a new report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva recently. Last year, that body voted in favor of establishing a permanent commission of inquiry into the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights in all the territory under its control, including inside the 1949 armistice line, demarcating the Zionist regime from the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime is nervous that the commission, led by three experts, whose report is expected to be published in June, will characterize it as an apartheid regime, according to a foreign ministry cable seen by the news publication Axios. Link's new periodic report as a special rapporteur to the UN Human Rights Council follows a handful of studies from high-profile Israeli and international human rights organizations concluding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians, mainstreaming and aspects of what their Palestinian counterparts have been saying about the Zionist regime rule for decades. Acknowledging the seeming performance of the Zionist regime's military occupation, human rights groups are also calling for an approach centered on rights and accountability rather than moribund peace process towards a two-state solution championed by the United Nations and other entities complicit in the prolonged situation of injustice in Palestine. The Zionist regime has refused to cooperate with the Human Rights Council Commission of Inquiry and has denied entry and boycotted Link and experts who have previously held the role of a special rapporteur for human rights in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Link notes that, consistent with the mandate of the special rapporteur, his periodic report focuses on Israeli practices in the West Bank, including East al-Quds and Gaza. As such, he does not examine policy towards Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories or Palestinian refugees in exile, but acknowledges that Palestinian, Israeli and international groups have concluded that it is impossible to have democracy here and apartheid there. Link observes that, by their very nature, occupations are required to be built with wood, not concrete. With the establishment of 300 Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank since 1967, and a massive wall built mostly on Palestinian land in the same territory, the Zionist regime occupation has involved a great amount of concrete. Meanwhile, in Gaza, for the past 15 years, Palestinians there have been barricaded into an open-air prison, Link states, adding a method of population control unique in the modern world. People in Gaza have endured four highly asymmetrical wars with the Zionist regime during that time, with enormous loss of human life and immense property destruction. The Zionist regime leaders have regularly and openly proclaimed that the regime's rule over the Palestinians and their land is permanent and that no Palestinian state will emerge, Link adds. The intent is for the Palestinians to be encased in a political ossuary, a museum relic of 21st century colonialism. The human rights expert observes that an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression is at the heart of the Zionist regime's settler colonial project in Palestine. For example, Israelis residing in Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank enjoy comprehensive rights, while Palestinians in the same territory live under military rule and control. The Zionist regime settlement enterprise is meanwhile meant to demographically engineer an unlawful sovereignty claim through the annexation of territory. And because it is impossible for a colonial power to expropriate land and resources for its own population without also immiserating the indigenous people and triggering their perpetual rebellion, the Zionist regime has imposed increasingly harsh methods of control over Palestinians. The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza therefore passed the test of applicability of an international legal definition of apartheid, Linke states. He observes that only the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1973, the Rome Statute providing the foundation of the International Criminal Court, drafted 25 years later, provide legal definitions for apartheid. A contemporary legal definition of apartheid drawn from and consistent with both the Convention and the Rome Statute would stipulate there exists an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression and discrimination, established with the intent to maintain the domination of one racial group over another, and which features inhumane acts committed as an integral part of the regime. All three features must be fulfilled for a situation to be considered one of apartheid, Link adds. Examples or patterns of racial discrimination by themselves are insufficient. The social construction of racial identity should be seen as a matter of perception, particularly in the eyes of a dominant group that distinguishes itself from other groups based on social markers such as nationality, ethnicity, religion, ancestry, and descent, Link says. In the case of the Zionist regime and the Palestinians, the former has determined the allocation and the denial of the rights in the occupied Palestinian territory through a series of laws, practices, and policies which define who is a Jew and who is not a Jew, according to Link. Under this system, the freedoms of one group are inextricably bound up in the subjugation of another. Palestinian human rights group welcomed Link's seminal report, the first by UN Special Rapporteur to definitely state that the Zionist regime practices apartheid. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime officials rejected Link's findings. Mariavi Elion-Sahar, the Zionist regime permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva, accused the independent expert of recycling baseless and outrageous libels. She added that Link aims to delegitimize and criminalize the regime of Israel for what it is, the state of Jewish people with equal rights for all citizens, she baselessly claimed. As Link notes in his report, however, the 5 million Palestinians under the Zionist regime military occupation are stateless and living without rights, in an acute state of subjugation and with no path to self-determination. And as for the more than 1.5 million Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, the lie of democracy is dispelled by Benjamin Netanyahu, whose office as prime minister ended last year after more than a decade, saying Israel is not a state of all citizens, but the state of Jewish people and them alone.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the ethical features of dining table. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the ethical features of the dining table. And we will talk about one of the most important features, which is to not look at the people who are present at the dining table while you're eating. It is said that in the Islamic lifestyle, because you are sitting on a dining table and there are other people who are sitting next to you, it is important, it is ethical to not look at them, because everyone should feel free while they're eating. Therefore, if we can have our eyes on our plates only and get busy in eating what we are eating, therefore others will also feel comfort while they're eating next to you. And if we keep looking at them, at the other people, it will bring uncertainty, it will bring a kind of uncomfortability in the place where we are sitting and eating next to each other. So therefore, it is important that when you're sitting on the dining table, pay attention to the plate which is in front of you and eat from it, and to not to keep looking at the others, that what they are eating, how they are eating. Maybe we do not have this intention to look like what is that person is eating, how they eat, and how they react on the dining table. But if even without this intention, you just look at the other person, it makes the other person uncomfortable that while he's eating, there is an eye which is looking at him. So therefore, he cannot eat it the way he wants it. And it is said to not to look at the others while eating. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the ethical feature of the dining table, and we said it is ethical to not look at the others while eating. On the other hand, we see that in Islam, there is a lot of emphasis on not to eating alone. Now, if someone wants to say that, okay, if in Islam it is said, it is recommended, it is ethical to not to look at others while eating, so why should I just not eat alone? And I just go and eat alone and I do not eat with the others. Well, it is said in Islam that it is also recommended to eat with the others. It is not recommended to eat alone. Because when you share your food with someone else, when you're eating with another mu'min or believer who's with you, then Allah brings more barakah, more blessing on that table. It gives more blessing to what you eat. Therefore, it is recommended to eat. In the history, we can say, for example, in the history of the prophets, it is said, like the Prophet Abraham alayhi salam, he never ate food alone. He always had someone next to him when he used to sit on the dining table. On the other hand, in the life of the eighth Imam, Imam Radha alayhi salam, we see that kana idha jalasa ala al-ma'ida, whenever he used to sit at the dining table, la yada'u thagiran wa la kabiran hatta السَّائِسَ وَالْحَجَّامَ إِلَّا أَقْعَدَهُ مَعَهُ عَلَى مَائِدَةٍ. He never sits at the dining table unless until he had everyone next to him. For example, from the small and big, from the, we can say, a laborer who's working out there at his house or anyone else who's present there. So he always used to sit with others and eat it. And similarly, we see this in the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam as well, that he never ate alone. But there are ethics that we need to follow. You need to invite others to the dining table. And once you have invited them, let them eat whatever they want and keep your eyes lure to your place and eat what is in front of you, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
All great economic decisions should be defined on the basis of the economy of resistance. Imagine that we sign a financial or industrial contract with such and such a country. It should become clear where in the economy of resistance this contract is situated. If we think that the economic improvement of the country is achieved only through foreign investment, this is a mistake. Of course, foreign investment is a good thing, but it fills in only one of the blanks on the table. What is more important than foreign investment in activating domestic capacities? We have many dormant capacities that should be activated. This is more important. Of course, foreign investment is necessary to exist alongside. But if we make everything dependent on foreign investment, this is also a mistake.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes it is said that they bring new technologies with them. Very well, this is all right. We agree with bringing in new technologies, of course, if they really do so. However, even if they do not bring them, as I have said before, can our youth, who have made achievements in the area of nanotechnology, in the nuclear area, and in the area of building complicated technologies, and who have helped Iran to be among the first of 5 to 10 countries in the world in many areas, not do something to make our oil wells produce more oil? Can they not improve our oil refineries? Or can they not improve the other areas which need to be improved and in which we need foreign technology? Certainly, if this technology is transferred during our transactions with foreigners, this is all right with us, and we do not have any objections. Notice that today, meticulous analysts who work on economic and political matters of the world bet on our country's economy of resistance. The issue is of which such great importance and sensitivity. They argue and bet on whether the economy of resistance that Iran has brought up will or will not produce results. It is of such tremendous importance. Therefore, this defines our independence. This was the third criterion that we discussed.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to push the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations.
Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the words Washington in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships, despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdollahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago, I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdollahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michel Aoun stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impact on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Prime Minister Mikati, Abdollahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
the U.S. pressure and the Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living. This is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubayri, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdullahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feedstocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are, in fact, 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence, but it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late. and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the